the Rise Up See Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. This is episode 363, and I'm Jess Root, your host from CardsWire.com, the USA Today NFL wire site covering the Arizona Cardinals. This is still not one of our regular editions, whether our regular episodes. Seth Cox is not with me in this edition of the show. It is the fifth installment of our six opponent preview shows, and it is part two of our NFC South opponent previews, as we will take a look at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the Atlanta Falcons, the Cardinals' Week 16 and Week 17 opponents. So in this edition of the show, I sit down with the managing editors for BucksWire.com and FalconsWire.com. We're going to start off with the Buccaneers, whom they face on Christmas night. That's coming next. All right, next up in our preview set, opponent preview shows or segments, is Luke Easterling, who actually has a ton of hats here over at the NFL Wire Network because he has run the draft side, Draft Wire, and on again, off again, but is now on again over at Bucks Wire. So he has multiple hats here. I can't remember if, I think this is the first time you have been on for one of the podcast preview shows, because I think, did you come on a year or two ago when they faced the Bucks before? I can't, or if I had another,
it probably was someone else. I came back to the Bucks Wire part of it.
Cause I remember Bonnie, before, but then I don't remember who took over after that.
Oh geez. Who was after Bonnie? I'm going to lose that. I can't remember who took over for Bonnie, but yeah, I came back in the September, like right before the Brady season. So it was 2020. Cause I did Bucks Wire off and on. I was helping Bonnie out for a little while. And then I left and did Buck stuff for Sports Illustrated for a little while. And then I came back right before that Brady season started. So I've been back at Bucks Wire since that 2020 season.
But Luke is a friend. Like, Luke's obviously a friend of the show. He's also like Seth Cox, my co-host, knows you pretty well as well. In the draft
community. Yes, I know so. Seth. Yep.
And so glad to have you on as we talk about the Buccaneers, as Tampa Bay will be the Cardinals' opponent on Christmas night at home at State Farm Stadium. Tampa Bay has a lot of Arizona connections still, but what we want to do is kind of go back over this last season, which did not end the way the Bucs wanted it to be. After winning their championship in the 2020 season, they didn't quite make it that far. So, as we look at last season, was it kind of a championship or bust type of scenario, or like how disappointing was it to end short of the Super Bowl?
I mean, it was super disappointing, and I think that if you kind of look at the way things happened after that game, it feels like championship or bust, because I feel like they beat the 49ers in Tampa the next week. And I feel like I like their chances against the Bengals in the Super Bowl too. You know, I think we all knew that the Rams were probably going to be the toughest opponent on that road, especially once, you know, you saw San Francisco with the upset, and that would have given the Bucks home field advantage in that title game. So, you know, it was kind of the opposite of the 2020 season in just about every way, right? The 2020 season, they didn't have a great start. The regular season, again, they were 7-5 at one point and would then finish so strongly and win 8 games in a row, still made the playoffs as a wild card, didn't even win the division. And then obviously the ridiculous playoff run, they go on the road 3 straight weeks. They beat Washington. They beat Drew Brees in his last game in New Orleans and avenge that sweep in the regular season. They go to Green Bay and beat Aaron Rodgers and Lambeau at the NFC Championship. And then obviously the ridiculous dominant win in the Super Bowl. And that was just ridiculous. But again, the regular season was kind of rocky and it built up to that. Last season was the opposite, right? They set the franchise record for regular season wins. The Bucs had never won 13 games in a regular season. They did that last year. They won the NFC South for the first time in over a decade. So they went into the playoffs and even got a little bit of help there in the last week that gave them a higher seed. and gave them that home field advantage for the first 2 weeks of the playoffs. And they had a big dominant win over the Eagles. Probably could have been a lot worse. It was 31-0 in the third quarter. And they kind of called the dogs off a little bit at the end and made the score not really indicative of how ridiculous that game was. But, and then the following week, I mean, what can I say? You know, they had home field advantage, everything going for them. And they just, that first half, they just did not show up. They got out coached, they got outplayed, and they looked really, really bad. They looked unprepared and completely not ready to be on the stage they were on. And it's absolutely a miracle that game came down to the final seconds with, again, you know, a ridiculous comeback by Tom Brady. And a lot of people talk about that comeback and being one of his iconic ones. You're down 27-3 in the third quarter, late third quarter, and you make that a tie game in the final minutes. But I think people ignore the fact people have been blaming, at least in Bucktown, you know, people are blaming Todd Bowles for that play call at the end that let Coop get Cooper Kupp get deep. And obviously he would like to have that one back, but that comeback doesn't happen if his defense doesn't go out and cause turnover after turnover after turnover in the final 20 minutes of that game to keep handing the ball back to Tom Brady over and over and over again for those touchdowns they got at the end. So, I mean, they somehow made that a game at the end, and they almost got the ball back again. I don't know if you remember that, but Matt Stafford fumbled the ball on the first down play in that final drive. And if they had gotten that ball, it would have been over. The Bucks would have kicked the field goal, run the clock out, and won that game. So it was absolutely championship or bust from the beginning. It definitely had that feeling to it. Once that, when Leonard Fournette went in for that touchdown and tied the game, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. He's going to do it again. He's going to do it again. And again, just a weird call. It didn't look like the communication was very good. And some people, you know, who were supposed to blitz did too late because they didn't know the call. And there was just too much confusion. And you had, you know, arguably the best receiver in the league one-on-one with a safety. A really good one at Antoine Winfield, but that's still an unfair. That's
right.
Unfair. And honestly, you know, if you want to get in the weeds about it, people are like, oh, you should have just been, you know, soft coverage again. Well, they ran that on the previous play, and Cooper Kupp beat Sean Murphy Bunting for like 20 yards and got out of bounds. So if they had done that on the next play, it would have been field goal range anyway. So it's people overreact, I think, a little bit to that play, but the fact that they were even in that game is ridiculous because they played like garbage for most of the first three quarters. So,
Rams had their season mirrored what the Bucks did the previous year.
Right,
only they ended up winning the division because the Cardinals collapsed. But it was Matthew Stafford's playoff run, and he got the Cinderella story. I felt coming into last season that the Rams were the favorites because of how hard it is to repeat in the league. But man, that both teams really all season sort of met every sort of expectations. Tom Brady, who, you know, remember Tom Brady was washed up in like 2016.
Oh my gosh. I love it.
I disliked Tom Brady very much early in his career.
Oh, we all did. Yeah.
But, you know, as I've gotten a little older, I'm like, how can you not like this guy because he's hard to deal with on the field sometimes, he loves football. He loves his teammates. We're never going to see anything like this again. Because even like as great as Patrick Mahomes is, there is almost no way at all that he's going to be able to do what Tom Brady did. And he got more likable. And I rooted for Tom Brady, and especially rooted for the Bucks against the Rams because the Rams.
Yeah. And I'll agree with you that it was Matthew Stafford's magical playoff run, but I really hope he sent a very large fruit basket to Jaquaski Tartt for dropping that interception.
Yes.
Because that run doesn't happen if he catches that football. So that was a magical moment.
It was. And I know that Matthew Stafford, like you said before we started recording, we root for players more than teams. Obviously, there are teams I root for, but there are so many players that I respect throughout the league and like to see being successful. And Matthew Stafford's one of them because he reminded me a lot of Carson Palmer. I wish they would have gone out and got Stafford about 2017, 2018. Didn't happen. But yeah, it's good to see a guy who's had a career like that to finally hit the precipice. And I'm just sad because we never do.
That's for sure, man. And and being in doing draft work for as long as I have, there's always somebody on whatever team that wins the Super Bowl that, you know, that I've either had time to interview and speak with and get to know over the years from the scouting process, especially if it's a later round guy that, you know, during the draft process, nobody really knew about. And I got to know that person. So Cooper Kupp is one of those guys. I remember speaking with him at the Senior Bowl and spending time with this guy from Eastern Washington that was like, you know,
he's the son of a former third string quarterback for the Cardinals. I remember
exactly.
Craig
it
Kupp.
Was like a, yeah, it was a plucky little story. Right. And then he becomes what he becomes. So it is always fun to be able to root for those stories.
So coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, best of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's move on to the offseason, because the Bucs, it was been an interesting
pretty
time.
Pretty boring for the Bucs. Not a whole lot of epic storylines. So, go away.
We'll talk more about that coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, best of Cardinals talk on the web. The offseason, it looked like the Bucs were going to be making a big transition as Tom Brady, well, first, it's reported that Tom Brady's going to retire. He says, wait, no, I haven't decided. Then he says, yeah, I'm going to retire. And then a little bit later, he unretires. What was that like for in Tampa Bay? Because you went from, you know, okay, we're going to run it back to, oh, crap, we need a quarterback. And you have Bruce Arians talking about, you know, Blaine Gabbert.
Like, right.
Now, I understand this. Bruce loves his guys. Like there was a special relationship he had with Drew Stanton, and then since 2017 with Blaine Gabbert. I don't necessarily get it, but there is a part of him that even though Arians has had great success with some of the greatest quarterbacks that there have been in the league, but he loves his backups. Loves them. It's weird.
Yeah. By the way, my favorite Blaine Gabbert story, by the way, is I was in the locker room in 2019. And he spent most of that season injured, had a shoulder injury and didn't play much. But we were in the locker room one day for open locker room and practice. Remember open locker room? Remember when that existed?
Let's come back this year. It should be best
We'll tell long stories about that. But I remember being in there and Blaine is having a very like in-depth, adamant, animated conversation with the team chef. Huh? Would come into the locker room and had this huge slab of like steak, like some really fancy steak that he was explaining to Blaine, like this particular way to cook it, this particular treatment, like, oh, you need to do this and this and this and this. And I'll just remember Blaine Gabbert literally like hanging on every word and like taking notes and literally being like, thank you, chef. Thank you so much, chef. Like afterwards and like was just so happy to be soaking up this knowledge about how to cook this steak and was super stoked to take it home and throw it on the grill. It was just, I don't know, the most random thing, but I just thought it was so cool. This NFL quarterback is like taking notes on how to cook this steak.
Oh, I there was a covering baseball a decade ago in spring training. There was a conversation that I caught between a couple of players they were talking about shower habits. There was a particular teammate. They like, why doesn't he use soap? And it ended up kind of being, and anyway, it kind of been. It
That's
was,
when the best you get the best stuff.
It was just hearing this conversation. They're like, right? No. They're like, so I'm not going to say who it was, but there was a couple of black players and talking about a white player. Like he doesn't use soap. I don't understand. talking about the way they shower. It was hilarious. One of those moments where like, wow, this is cool. Because I think it was my first year covering a team in a locker room that year, and so it was like, wow, that's one of those things.
This is how it is.
This is how it is. And now we don't know what that.
I think
like.
Exactly. I remember we were standing around
room?
Anthony. We're going all over the place here, but like I was standing, I was asking Anthony Nelson a question, the backup outside linebacker for the Bucs, and he's answering me. But you get that feeling when someone's kind of looking past you while they're talking to you. And he's looking kind of like at me, but not at me. And he keeps like trying not to smile and laugh, but he can't. And so he's like trying to answer my question. But in the middle of it, he keeps stopping to like try to stifle a smile over and over. And I'm like, what does this do? Like, do I have something on my face? Do I have something in my teeth? Like, what is going on? And it wasn't until after the whole thing was done that I turn around and Raheem Nunez Rochas, who we call Nacho, who one of the biggest personalities in the game. He's got these awesome gold teeth and he's just a big, huge ball of energy. I look behind me and he's been standing on a chair behind, like right at eye level, making like faces and like making fun of, but he's like right in my ear. And I'm just like, okay, it's not me. I just want to make sure I wasn't, because he's Anthony Nelson is staring at me like I'm doing something funny, and I'm just like, I don't get it. So anyway, long tangent about locker room.
Absolutely, that's get back to the Brady. But, what was it like knowing that it? Did people believe that Brady was actually retired, or what's kind of the feeling at that point?
You know, I don't know that I could speak for everybody, but I think my feeling through the whole process was never really settled on, is he really not going to play? Like, even after the retirement announcement, it's just kind of like, man, are they really going to roll into the offseason with Gabbert and Trask, like Kyle Trask? Is this how it's going to be? Like, are we going to, but you never really felt like they thought that was the plan either. Like, they always were like,
Hey, we want him back.
I feel like I felt that way because the team felt that way. And, you know, from Bruce to Jason Light, the general manager, who obviously you guys know well. And there was just so much of this, like, you can't really be done. Like, there's not actually going to be. And it goes back to that Rams game part of it. You're like, there's no way he goes out like that. Like, eventually you have to. We understand that, like, you can't always win the Super Bowl at the end. And
you're not Peyton Manning or John Elway.
Right. It's hard. It's hard to do that.
And often Brett Favre.
I think we all just felt like it just wasn't. And a lot of people feel that way about Rob Gronkowski right now after his announcement yesterday. But like,
if his agent suggested it. Come on.
that didn't help. Thanks, Drew. Thanks, Drew, for just
undoing the retirement announcement.
I love it.
If Tom calls in November, he might come back.
Right. But no, I think the Brady thing was just, it didn't surprise me that he retired. It didn't surprise me when he came back. It doesn't surprise me that he's going to be their quarterback this year. I think what does surprise me is, you know, all the other conspiracy stuff and all the, oh, he's going to play for the 49ers and, oh, he hates Bruce Arians and that's why he retired and all that, you know, there's so much nonsense that flew around. That's the part of it that bothered me. I think that, what did we have, 40 days to think about whether or not Blaine Gabbert was actually going to be the quarterback? That was 40 days in the wilderness right there. That was excruciating thought process, because again, you look at the rest of the league and the landscape was okay. Well, what if not Brady, what then? Cause at that point, Russell Wilson, you're thinking, you know, you don't know what's happening with Deshaun Watson, but yeah,
I had Garoppolo pegged there.
Jimmy G, you got Baker Mayfield later in the process. There's so many different options, and then they all kind of started to dry up, and you're like, man, they're not going to have anything here. And so, wow, it was quite a roller coaster. And again, you throw in, you know, the Bruce Arians thing, and then he retires, and then everybody's like, oh yeah, see, I told you, that's the only reason he came back. And it's like, I get it. I get that people want things to be juicier than the truth sometimes, and I completely understand that it's just more fun to believe the lie sometimes, I guess.
So you didn't believe any of, like, obviously Bruce is he's hard on players, he's hard on his, well, publicly he will, like, he's both hard and very, and he's super stubborn, but at the same time Brady has always been very coachable. And now there was the stuff that came out of New England, there was the power struggle with him and Belichick, but did you believe for any minute that Tom Brady was unhappy with Bruce Arians?
Never once. And again, people will see me say that and be like, oh, you just, you know, you're a fanboy. You love the Bucks. You don't want to believe anything's wrong. I mean, go back and look at how I've covered this team, especially when they weren't very good. And when there's something to yell about and something to be mad about that this team does, I will be honest about it. I wasn't thrilled when they signed Antonio Brown. I made my displeasure very apparent there. So it's not like I'm going to carry water for the team here. But I'm just talking about what I see and what I observed and what I observed being around the team and seeing the way they interacted and watching. Go back to they said the same thing the year before, Jess. They said the same thing when they were 7-5 and, you know, the offense wasn't clicking still halfway through the season. And they were like, oh, it's because, you know, Brady's mad that he criticizes him in the press conferences, as if Brady's a friggin' 12-year-old who doesn't have thick enough skin at this after 22 years in the NFL to be able to take criticism publicly. And like, it was that kind of stuff that bothered me, that people are just like, oh, you know, they said the same thing then and they went and won a Super Bowl together. So it's just like, I think people, again, they would like for the story to be more interesting than the truth, which I believe the truth to be that Brady's retirement decision was its own thing. Yes. Bruce Arians' retirement decision, which again, you have to go back and look at Well, look at the pattern of behavior in Bruce Arians' life and career, and his relationship with Todd Bowles, his relationship to his coaches, and how important
a lot about his assistants.
Right. This is stuff I don't have to tell you and your listeners, right? You guys know this stuff. This is why it's so important to him. So
he felt wronged by Mike Tomlin when he was made to retire out of Pittsburgh. He was really hurt about that because he felt that Tomlin was going to go in and get him an extension, get him a new contract. So he has always cared deeply about his assistants and his legacy as well. And so when he came out and said, you know, this is the perfect time to go out because you've got a great team. Brady's back. I'm going to hand these over to Todd Bowles, who's capable, and I'm just going to move up. And then my staff stays intact. They have jobs and they're in a perfect position to be successful. And Arians has cared a lot about his legacy and his assistants, especially. He was disappointed when the Cardinals did not hire James Betcher to basically keep the staff intact there in for 2018.
And so he looked at this and he said it point blank. I saw an opportunity. He said it out loud with the ownership sitting there. He said, I didn't want to give them the opportunity to make a different hire.
Right.
He told them that to their faces in front of all of us. He said, if I stay here and I retire after the year and a whole band breaks up and they get to hire whoever they want. They didn't get to do that this time. I dictated exactly where this went. Like, whoever has that kind of power, you know what I mean? So, and again, there's so many elements to it. So I think what makes me most aggravated about that whole thing, the conspiracy thing about Brady and the Dolphins and the 49ers and all that stuff, which again, maybe there's some sort of kernel of truth to where if Brady, because Brady didn't really deny this part of it when he was asked about it after minicamp, you know, in terms of being involved with the Dolphins, if he stays retired and, you know, Stephen Ross calls him up because they're Michigan men and he wants to own part of the team, like that part makes sense to me. That's the part of it that I could be like, okay, I could see that. You know, you're talking about him. Oh, now we're going to get him and we're going to also get him to play quarterback, which would have taken a 3/4 vote from the owners to approve. And like, ah, okay, now we're, that's outlandish to me. That's kind of far-fetched. And that's really the only part that matters. It seemed like this was all being driven by people who just couldn't fathom that Brady would come back and play for the Bucs again on purpose. And again, we couldn't fathom why he did it in the first place. But like, I just don't know why people needed to believe that Brady doesn't want to be here, that Brady doesn't want to play in Tampa Bay after the experience he's had here, the talent they have here, the chance they have to keep competing for Super Bowls here. I just don't understand what people don't get about that. But it mostly made me angry because I felt like it was overshadowing what Bruce was doing for his staff, for his coaches, totally. for Todd, who is more than deserving of another chance to be a head coach. I feel like that got lost in everybody's need to blame this on Tom Brady. And that's really what kind of pissed me off about it, is that that was getting lost underneath all of that. And I think it's something that should have been much more celebrated than it has been.
Absolutely. So in the offseason, so Brady's back. It's now Todd Bowles in charge. Who were the players who were lost in free agency draft in terms of trades, any of that? Who are the key losses entering this next season? And who was gained in free agency in the draft that should step in and their impact?
All right, so a bit of a different situation than last year, right? They came back after that Super Bowl with the entire starting lineup, all 22. Both sides of the ball, all the specialists were back as well, so technically 25. Most of the depth guys, that roster was pretty much intact. They didn't lose a whole lot. Not the case this time. They knew it wasn't going to be able to afford it. You and I were talking about hockey in the pod before the pod, before the show, and it's similar to what the Tampa Bay Lightning had to do this year, right? They won the cup. They knew they couldn't keep everybody. They pretty much lost their entire third line in free agency. Didn't seem to bother them that much as they're back in the finals again, but the Bucks knew they couldn't keep everybody this time. And that was evident in the fact that they lost some key starters in free agency. Jordan Whitehead, one of their starting safeties, went to the Jets. Alex Kappa, their starting right guard, went to the Bengals. O.J. Howard, a key tight end reserve guy, he went to the Bills. You lost, let's see, who else? Ronald Jones went to Kansas City, even though he was kind of – nobody really expected him to come back anyway. He wasn't really living up to the expectations.
Gronkowski retires.
Right. You know, you've got Gronkowski now who won't be back. He retired. So yeah, that's, and the big retirement, honestly, that I feel like everybody has forgotten about to a point is Ali Marpet.
Yeah.
Who is one of the best guards in the NFL and was really the most surprising. Everybody was talking about Gronk and Brady and whether they'll come back, and Sue, who obviously won't be back now. But you know, the Ali Marpet loss is a big one. And I think honestly, maybe the most important move the Bucs have made in an aggressive move, an offensive move to fill that spot, is getting Shaq Mason from New England for a fifth round pick. I think that may have been the heist of the offseason across the whole league, because that immediately solidifies one of those guard spots and gives you another, I think, Pro Bowl caliber player there. Again, I mentioned Ndamukong Suh, but I'd put him as one of the big losses that they'll have, because he won't be back now that the Bucs have signed. Again, one of their big additions this offseason is Akeem Hicks. They've filled that role, that veteran, run-stuffing defensive lineman role, so they won't be bringing Sue back now. Obviously, they had a draft class that they're expecting big things from. Logan Hall, their top pick, is a defensive lineman as well, more of a pass-rushing type of guy that'll probably rotate in as a rookie. Luke Gadecki, their second-round pick, probably compete for that left guard spot that was vacated by Ali Marpet. He'll be battling with Aaron Stinney, a guy who has started before for them. Robert Hainsey, a guy they drafted in the third round out of Notre Dame 2 years ago. And then, you know, the other guy that stands out in terms of the additions is Russell Gage. The number three receiver in this offense is going to get a lot of targets anyway. And the lack of proven depth at that position was kind of exposed last year at times, and even the year before when some receivers went down. Obviously, you know what you're getting in Mike Evans. But especially with Rob Gronkowski not coming back now, assuming that's the case when we head into week one and he hasn't changed his mind. Russell Gage is going to play a huge role in this offense, and it shows by the fact that they gave him $10 million a year over 3 years. And the fact that, again, we still don't know when Chris Godwin is going to be back. Hopefully, obviously, we'd love to have him week one, but you have a torn ACL and a serious knee injury in December. It's not out of the realm of possibility that he would not be ready, obviously, for the first few games of the season. So Russell Gage basically becomes the number two receiver in this offense until Godwin comes back. And if you don't have Gronkowski, that's going to be an even more important role. So expect Mike Evans, obviously, to get more targets if that's the case. But Russell Gage is going to be he's somebody that, again, Tom Brady reached out to personally and went to the team, was like, I want this guy. We need to get this guy. So Brady's not doing that unless he's planning on feeding him the ball quite a bit. So those are really the big ones. Again, Cade Otton, who's a fourth round pick out of Washington, he'll now be a bit more important, I think, in the offense with Gronkowski not coming back. He's that big, athletic, versatile tight end that they'll hope can develop into anywhere near the player Gronk was. Obviously, he's kind of a unicorn, but that's kind of what they need him to be in this offense now, a guy that can do it all. That's the rest of everybody is pretty much back. They've got a lot of key starters back at key positions. The two additions that I think could make the biggest difference on defense, they went and got two really good, cheap veterans in Logan Ryan and Keanu Neal, who bring athleticism, intelligence, the ability to communicate because of their experience in multiple defenses. Logan Ryan can play safety, can play in the slot, can play corner. Keanu Neal's played linebacker and safety at this level. Those two guys coming in and giving more veteran experience to a pretty young secondary still, I think is going to make a huge difference for how consistently this defense is able to play well.
Question on Logan Hall. Do you see him, because he was a guy that the Cardinals really liked as well. And my co-host Seth, he's talked about what his future is. Do you see him playing more interior defensive end, or out in that outside linebacker position?
He's definitely an interior guy. And again, it's hard, you know, today's NFL, there's not really a whole lot of 3-4 and 4-3 teams. There's nobody really plays a straight base 3-4 or 4-3 anymore. It's a lot of hybrid stuff. It's a lot of under and over fronts, and everybody's moving around. And honestly, most every defense is in nickel plus every play.
True. And so it's a four down.
There's not really any.
It's a four man front, pretty much.
Exactly. So in that alignment, he's going to be an interior guy. He's already beefed up, I think, to around 290. I think he said, which again, you're not putting your guy out in space at that size. So he's going to be a three tech, I think, in this defense. And again, he's got a similar build to William Golston, who's been in Tampa for about a decade now. But I think I think Will would admit he's a better athlete. He's a more explosive guy. And Will Golston has been a quality starter in Tampa Bay for a long, long time. And I think if you're telling me I'm getting that guy, but with better athleticism, better pass rush moves and more potential, That's worth the number 33 pick to me. And by all accounts, he's looked great in camp. Warren Sapp was down at training camp for a while, or down at mini camp, and said he liked what he saw as well. So I think that's going to be a really important pick for this team, even with the addition of Akeem Hicks. I think you've got Hicks and Vita Vea eating up all that space on the early downs, on running downs. And if you're able to put, you know, Shaq Barrett, Joe Tryon, Shoyinka, who will be a full-time starter now. We didn't even mention Jason Pierre-Paul, who obviously won't be back. They gave Logan Hall number 90, so that's when we knew that JPP definitely wouldn't be coming back. But, you know, we're expecting big things out of him in his second year after being a first-round pick last year. But, yeah, Logan Hall is going to make a difference, because this defense, we knew that interior, that defense needed to get more athletic, more explosive, and needed to get after the quarterback and push that pocket from the inside to help out those guys on the outside like Shaq Barrett. And I think that's exactly what they got. They got the perfect fit there in Logan Hall.
Kind of like what the Cardinals had in Calais Campbell. Not quite as tall, but I see him be able to do some of the same things that Calais did in that position for the Cardinals back in the day before he went full-time edge and, you know, when he got paid $15 million a year from the Jaguars and then exploded as a pass rusher.
Yeah, but, yeah. And again, you're talking about unicorns. I mean, not a lot of people are as big as Calais Campbell and can do what he can do on the edge and live in space like that at that size. That dude is just, he's one of a kind.
He is. So coming next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's now look ahead to the 2022 season, expectations, and how they perhaps match up with the Cardinals. That's coming next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We've talked about kind of the offseason additions, the offseason subtractions, obviously slightly different coachings, new head coach, quarterbacks back. What are sort of the expectations for Tampa going forward? I look at the NFC South, and I see that the Bucs should be the prohibitive favorites to come out of the division, and Panthers, not good. Falcons, not good. Saints, we don't know. I see the Saints as a team that will maybe compete for the wild card, but I don't love what they are yet. And so they have a pretty, like, perceived easy route out of the division.
Yeah, I think it'll be similar to last year, right? Where, you know, the Falcons might be the worst team in the whole league in terms of the overall level of talent on the roster. The Panthers might not be far off. They got a couple of players here and there, but I don't think either of those teams will compete.
Sam Darnold's their starter. Come on.
Yeah. I'd roll with Matt. I'd go Matt Corral from day one if I had to over Sam Darnold. I'd just rather run with the rookie and see what happens. But the Saints are an interesting thing, because I don't know that it matters who plays for the Saints. Right now, the Bucs have a mental block when they play that team that is just insurmountable at this point. Tom Brady has 0-4 against them in the regular season since he came to Tampa. Obviously, they got the one that mattered in the playoffs, right? And we'll make that trade all day long. But I mean, the Saints haven't just beaten the Bucs; they've embarrassed the Bucs multiple times, blowing them out at home on national TV in the Super Bowl season, and then shutting them out 9-0 in the same exact scenario the year after. I mean, the Bucs have to get over that hump, and they're going to have to do it for me to believe it. I think, again, the Saints are a mediocre team on paper right now. You don't really know what Jameis Winston is going to give them over 16 games, 17 games as a starter. You know, you don't know if Alvin Kamara is going to start to wear out from all the touches he's gotten at that offense. You don't know so much. Like you said, you just don't know. They've got some pieces on defense. I think they'll still be one of the better defenses in the league. Dennis Allen knows what he's doing with that group. But you just don't know. I think if they sweep the Bucs in the regular season again, but also miss the playoffs and the Bucs win the NFC South by a decent margin again, I don't think that's surprising to me. Because, again, until they can prove they can beat them, I have to believe it when I see it. But the rest of that division is so, so weak. And I think that as long as the Bucs can at least split some of those road games and some of those tough home matchups, they've got a much tougher schedule this year. I still think they'll be able to win that division comfortably and head into the playoffs with a home game.
And I feel that way about the kind of each division in the NFC, that I feel that there is a clear favorite with a handful of teams that are kind of in the mix. So got the Rams again in the NFC West, got the Packers, you got the Cowboys, you got the Bucks. And then you've got teams like the Cardinals and the Eagles and the Vikings and the 49ers. I actually don't love the 49ers this year as much as I did last year, because Shanahan is 8-28 with anyone other than Jimmy Garoppolo. So I'm I don't know. The betting people, they love the 49ers. I don't get it. Trey Lance.
Yeah, you can have them.
Trey Lance, he's not Patrick Mahomes. He's not going to come out in year two and do what Mahomes did. It's just not going to happen. But I feel like the Cardinals are potentially at the top end of those wild card teams. As we look at the Cardinals and Bucks facing each other late in the year, what is the perception? What is your view of what the Cardinals have to offer in terms of competition with the Bucks? I'm not asking for a prediction. That's too late. They're playing on Christmas, so way too early.
Right. Well, I think particularly on defense, I think the biggest thing that I see is the fact that Chandler Jones isn't going to be there. And I think that if I'm Tom Brady, I'm really happy about that. I'm a guy who needs a clean pocket to do what I do. And Chandler Jones is a guy who has been a huge problem for quarterbacks during his time, his whole career. So the fact that I'm not going to have to deal with him is a big issue out of the way. Obviously there's some athleticism, some versatility in that defense. Buda Baker, I think, is one of the most underrated defenders in the entire league. So he's a guy that I think Brady's going to always have to find him, similar to the way he would have to do it with Tyrann Mathieu when they played the Chiefs. And again, the Saints beat the Bucks on defense really well because they run this double robber most of the time, where they basically just unleash their safeties to follow Brady's eyes, follow Gronk, follow Godwin, whoever he thinks are going to be the primary target, and kind of let those guys free roam. The Cardinals have that guy in Buda Baker and can let him kind of do those things. So they have the personnel to, I think, give Brady a few problems here and there. I just don't see them having enough in terms of the coverage and the pass rush up front to be able to make his life as miserable as you need to beat the Bucs. And then on defense, it's really about what defense shows up for the Bucs. Because I think on paper, they have the horses at every level to handle the best of what the Cardinals do. And again, when you're playing a quarterback like Kyler Murray, you'd better have linebackers who can run. And I don't know if there's a better set of linebackers when it comes to athleticism and range and sideline to sideline ability than what the Bucks have in Devin White and Lavonte David. So, you know, you've obviously got the guys that can contain him as best you can. And it's just about making him make decisions. You want to make him look like the worst version of himself that we saw at times last year, instead of the MVP version we saw when they were undefeated halfway through the season. So I think, again, the Bucks have all of those advantages on paper, but they have to execute. If they're not, you know, disciplined in their gap integrity, if they're not disciplined in keeping Kyler Murray contained and not letting him break the pocket and make plays on the run, you know, they've got the explosive playmaking ability to make you pay. So I think, again, as long as the Bucks play to their potential, I like them in that game, even on the road. But again, they've got to play like they can, or the Cardinals have the playmakers to expose them if they don't.
I see the Bucks as somewhere between an 11 to 14 win team and a team with a title ceiling. They should be in the mix for a title this year. Would that be roughly what you would expect out of this team coming up in 2022?
Absolutely. And I think within that building, it's nothing less than a Super Bowl. And obviously you have to look at it a little more critically than that and say, well, you know, you're going to be breaking in a new left guard, a new right guard. You don't have Gronk at tight end. You know, you're not going to have Godwin week one, probably. So you're breaking in a new receiver two in Russell Gage. You know, there's going to be some moving pieces there that you're going to have to acclimate to and may not be as smooth as you had last year. And last year's schedule was a bit easier. Again, that's all on paper based on last year, and we know how things can change. But right now, that schedule looks rough, especially right out the gate. They've got some really tough matchups, two straight road games. They come back home, and they've got the Packers and the Chiefs. I mean, it's going to be a tough start. I think that might help them in the long run, where they're going to get tested early, and even if it goes like they don't want it to, and maybe they come out of that 2-2, maybe even 1-3, I think facing all those really good teams early will beat them up a little bit and get them seasoned and ready to go down the stretch. I think they have a nice mid-season bye week that, again, it feels like the kind of season where it could be more like 2020, where it starts a little rough, but down the stretch they kind of find their groove and hopefully get hot again. But, yeah, the Super Bowl is absolutely the goal and maybe even the expectation for most Bucks fans.
All right. That is Luke Easterling from BucksWire.com and also DraftWire.com. He covers both sites for the USA Today NFL Wire. Luke, social media, anywhere else that my listeners can follow you?
Yeah, man, I keep it pretty simple on social media. It's just at Luke Easterling on Twitter, obviously at the Draft Wire, at the Bucks Wire for the site accounts there. And yeah, that's pretty much all I do.
All right, man. I appreciate the time. We'll have to talk again. We'll see how things turn out Christmas night. That's, again, Luke Easterling from Bucks Wire and from Draft Wire. Thanks for listening. We will move on to our next segment.
Coming up next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, we move on to our segment about the Atlanta Falcons, our final NFC South opponent preview. That's coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. Next up on our opponent preview series for the Rise Up C-Red podcast are the Atlanta Falcons, whom the Cardinals play in the second to last week of the regular season in Week 17 on the road. The last time they faced the Falcons was in 2019 in Kyler Murray's rookie season, one of the three straight wins they rattled off there in before the first half of the season wrapped up. But we're not here to talk about that 2019 game. We're here to look at the Falcons last season and their offseason and what we're looking forward to in the upcoming year. And for that, I've got Matt Urban, the managing editor from thefalconswire.com, which is the sister site on our USA Today NFL Wire that covers the Falcons. Matt, thanks for joining the show. Glad to have you on. Well, by the time this is not going to be published right away, we're recording on a Saturday at the end of June. And yeah, so it's hot here. It sounds like it's hot where you're at. So we're just finding ways to keep cool. How you been?
Great, man. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to talking some Falcons football, man. We got a busy offseason here. A lot more than the past couple of years combined, I feel like.
Yeah, and so last year it's an interesting team. If you look at how their season went, they had 7 wins. They had 7 wins last year, finishing 7-10. It was the fourth season in a row that they finished under 500. And obviously, but they were a 7-win team with a point differential of -146.
That's right.
How is that possible even?
Honestly, that is like a great question. And honestly, that's one of the first things I point at. Everyone says, you know, they won 7 games. If you watch those games, man, it was like they won the 7 games barely, and then they lost. They really lost. You know, you saw the Patriots game on Monday Night Football, or I think it was Thursday night. They didn't score a point, and their offense throughout stretches of the season was just absolutely the worst thing I've ever seen. But yeah, I mean, it's like they did find a way to squeak out a couple wins. So it's like, it's encouraging because, you know, they didn't have a great, you know, talent base there last year. And obviously Arthur Smith's first year coming in, you know, a lot changing, no Julio Jones first time. And Calvin Ridley, all that stuff happened. He's kind of has a missing year. You know, he leaves for personal issues, and it was all just kind of a crazy up and down season. Matt Ryan just barely hung on in there. You know, it was kind of year that you just, it's definitely the first year for Arthur Smith. Like, you know, there's a lot of good things. There's a lot of things that you just were like, oh man, he's got to get that fixed up. He's supposed to be an offensive guy, and they're not doing much here and there. But overall, I think there's like a clear direction of the team now going into the second year. Especially like after a mandatory minicamp, I think that they have more of an idea of what he's going for, you know.
Yeah. This year. What went well for them last year, and then what was obvious, and then what were the problems ultimately?
Right. So I think what went well is mostly just Cordarrelle Patterson. I mean, he was kind of just a revelation. The Falcons haven't had a running game in, you know, 3-4 years at all, really any kind of consistent running game, and all of a sudden, not that they were great running the ball last year, but Patterson kind of gave them, you know, just that ability to run the ball a little bit again, respect the run game a little bit. So yeah, they got just more, they were more of a physical team, I think. But really not much to say good about them overall as a defense. Like, I felt like they were scrappy, you know, like they hung in there a lot of games. They were kept it close, but they just didn't have the dogs. Like, the players were not there. And throughout most of the season, pretty much all the games were close, and they just really, really got away from them. And, so I think, like, going into the second year, there's a lot of areas they should be better at. But a lot they did well last year, honestly. I mean, yeah, passing the ball, throwing the ball, stopping the run, stopping the pass. They were pretty much at the bottom of any of those categories if you look at it.
Well, they did have a couple of bright spots offensively. You mentioned one, Cordarrelle Patterson.
Kyle Pitts,
long time in the NFL and fantastic returner. Has always underwhelmed as a receiver.
and you know, put him in a running back role, and guess what? He was really great. And then, yes, then the other guy that you watch is Kyle Pitts. How good was he as a rookie?
You know, he was good. He had a couple of really good games, you know, really promising games. I think the London game against the Jets, he went for like 150 yards, and he definitely looks really promising, but it wasn't quite as, you know, impressive of a season game to game as you would have thought. You know, he had one touchdown. You know, he was kind of brought in to be a red zone threat, and they didn't really figure that out last year. But definitely got like crazy upside, and you know, a lot of it was more just the offensive line was so bad last year. Like they couldn't, you know, it was Matt Ryan had half a second, and when he did, there was no one even the receivers he was throwing to were, you know, his fourth and fifth guys going into the year. So it was just kind of a big mess in terms of that. But Pitts definitely was a bright spot. Really fast, really athletic, kind of really did play well lining up outside a little bit. You know, I know people thought that he was kind of just in general pass catcher, not a true tight end. But yeah, I think overall going into this year, he looks like a really, you know, solid core piece that they're going to go on using a lot this year.
You talked about Arthur Smith. What is the feeling of him as a head coach, especially after 1 year and having a very interesting year, to say the least? How do people feel about Arthur Smith moving forward?
I'd say they're right in the middle right now. You know, the record over time has kind of brought people back. During the season, I think people were pretty down on him throughout watching the games, but, you know, 7-10 record overall. He's kind of I wouldn't say a shy guy, but he's not like the most outspoken kind of guy. So he was definitely a little uncomfortable throughout the year, you know, talking to the media, getting used to all that kind of stuff. And the team seems to be behind him, though. You know, I think he kind of was a little more confident seeming this year. He's a better clear vision of what he's trying to do. And like last year, you know, they're dealing with so much, you know, turmoil, you know, trying to go from this pass heavy team to this run first system without the players to do it whatsoever. You know, they have a couple good offensive linemen and Chris Lindstrom and, you know, Jake Matthews, obviously, but the rest of it has just been, you know, really, really poor and turning over a lot. So I think it was a solid year for him. You know, he got 7 wins. It was the most they've had in a couple of years before that. They had 4 wins the previous year. And you could say they had a worse team last year than they did the previous year. So I think overall, I would say it was like a successful first year. But fans are definitely want to wait and see approach a little bit with him a little bit, I think, too.
Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, Best of Cardinals Talk on the web. We're going to talk about the Falcons offseason. Who did they lose? Who did they trade? Who did they gain? That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the Best of Cardinals Talk on the web. And let's talk about what, obviously, the biggest thing that they did in the offseason was the decision to move on from Matt Ryan. Did you feel at this point in his career, was it time to move on?
Personally, yes. I've been of that thought for about 2 years. And it's not because I'm not a great fan of Matt Ryan. You know, I have great respect for what he does, what he's done here. But it just, his contract has been eating this team up, you know, for the past couple of years. And they kind of just keep kicking the can down the road. You know, they kept just, you know, renegotiating his deal, pushing the money down. And then his cap hit has been, you know, hurting them for years in a row. And like, it's why they haven't been able to add any free agents the past few seasons. And I think it's right. They made the right move here, kind of just like taking the hit, you know, he's got like a $64 million dead cap hit or something total. And so I think they're doing the right thing here. It might be, you know, a bit of a transition, but Matt Ryan is ready to play on a better team. He's been, you know, I think it's going to be a little bit of a Matt Stafford situation where the fans will probably see him doing well on the Colts and also be happy about, you know, a new day in Atlanta. Because if you watch them the past few years, it's not like Ryan hasn't been, he's been a solid quarterback. He's been really good. His lack of mobility with the way the team is structured with the offensive line, the middle of it being so weak, it's been kind of a disaster. So I think he deserves a situation like the Colts where they have, you know, a good, they're solid up front and, good running game and everything. And I think, so ultimately, I think it was the right move. It's a tough decision to make. Obviously, the guy's been here for 13 years and fans love the guy and former MVP. But yeah, I think it was the right move ultimately.
And that leads us to the quarterback change, which is instead of drafting a quarterback in the first round, now we'll talk about their draft in just a moment, but they moved to Marcus Mariota, a guy that Arthur Smith is familiar with and comfortable with. What is the feeling about Marcus Mariota entering 2022 in terms of how he can lead the team? Is he pretty much the guaranteed starter? Is there a competition between him and Desmond Ridder?
Yeah, I think I think the idea with the general thought process around Mariota is it's cautious optimism. I think that like I assume he's going to be the starter. I wouldn't say it's like in stone, but you know, Arthur Smith tends to be a little bit, he tends to be a little bit tentative with rookies. Like he didn't play Richie Grant much last season, the second round pick. So I kind of have a hard time seeing that Ridder is going to go out there and be the starter week one, but I wouldn't, you know, rule him out getting on the field at some point. Last year they ran, Felipe Franks was their number two quarterback, and he's kind of a run first guy. And Arthur Smith liked to throw packages with him out there to kind of, you know, mix it up a bit. So I think he'll probably get on the field, but Mariota seems like it's going to be his first shot here. And obviously he has a past with Arthur Smith. You know, they were together in Tennessee, and, you know, Arthur Smith actually kind of, I wouldn't say he gave up on him, but he was a guy that benched him in favor of Tannehill, you know. And, but obviously the relationship was fine because they, you know, mended it and he signed here. But, you know, I think people are wondering if they can kind of have if Arthur Smith can kind of have a, you know, similar situation here with Mariota as he did with Tannehill, because Tannehill was also a top pick, you know, and a little bit, you know, he was on a second opportunity. So, yeah, I think it's probably Mariota's team so far, but I'm not going to rule out Ridder getting in there.
If we look at the players that the Falcons lost, obviously Matt Ryan is the big one. That's a big transition when you go from a more than a decade long franchise quarterback who is aging. Eventually you have to cut ties. But the other surprise was, I'm sure Falcons were expecting a return of Calvin Ridley, only to find out that he got suspended for the year for betting on football while he was away from the team. How impactful is that loss? Or better yet, was he going to be moved? And so this was just a case where they lost out on some sort of compensation for him.
Yeah, that seems like what they were kind of indicating once the suspension came out, that they had offers on the table for Ridley and had been planning to move him, it seemed like. But what gets lost in all that is that when he was on the field last season, he wasn't a great fit in the system. I don't know if it was whatever was going on with him off the field, but, you know, he was not effective last season when he was on the field. And so once he left, they never really said what it was for. It was just a personal leave. I don't know if he said he was going to get his mental health together or something like that. But, you know, so I don't think he was in the long-term plans, and it sounded like they're going to trade him. So now it's kind of an interesting situation because his contract gets pushed to next year. So I don't know if they're going to, you know, maybe they reset and kind of see how things are going with him, or they just look to move him immediately or what. But yeah, it's kind of complicated there with Ridley for sure.
Who else were impact losses, whether they had been cut, losses in free agency or whatnot?
Okay, for sure. Definitely number one, Foye Oluokun, middle linebacker. He led the league in tackles last year. Really good player that's developed, you know, as a sixth round pick out of Yale, I think. Yeah, really good player. He signed with the Jags over the offseason. And then Russell Gage, who was kind of de facto number one receiver last year, signed with Tampa Bay. And, you know, that's a pretty big loss, too. And that's really the main two. And then Ridley, obviously. And then Dante Fowler. He was released, but he technically didn't. It was like the contract was not actually 2 years. It was like a one-year deal. Had a void thing, right?
Okay.
So that's a loss, but that was kind of expected. So overall, I mean, they pretty much got rid of everyone. And, I mean, they didn't re-sign many guys. And they brought in a few big names. Once they got a little cash, they brought in, I don't know if you want to do that after this or not, but
no, go ahead. That leads right in what's next.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So they traded for Bryan Edwards, receiver from the Raiders, who's kind of looks like an up and coming guy. They got traded for a fifth round pick and they gave up a seventh. And yeah, it looks like he's going to be a starter probably. And then they signed Rashawn Evans, middle linebacker out of Tennessee. He's figured to be a starter, replacing Oluokun. And then what else I guess here? Oh, Lorenzo Carter, the edge out of Giants, free agent from the Giants, former Georgia Bulldog. He signed here, 1 year deal. And mostly the draft picks draft's gonna play a huge role too, I think.
Yeah. A couple other names that they bring up are Casey Hayward, a guy, but gotta stay healthy. Damir Bird is a familiar name for Cardinals fans. He was here in Arizona. He's fast, so he can give you something. But you look at that wide receiver core, You've got, you know, so is Gage is gone. Who is your number? As we talk about Drake
London. Number one receiver?
Yeah. So,
right.
Who is, yeah, we'll talk about Drake London in just a second, but before the draft, what did that receiver core look like? What did it look like for the starting receivers?
Right. It was bare. I did a lineup projection before the draft, and I was just looking at it actually. I had Auden Tate was another free agent signing they got, who's got like very little experience. And Edwards obviously being there now, but before they traded for Edwards, I mean, I think I had Bird in there at one point. I mean, there's so little. Olamide Zaccheaus, he resigned re-signed his tender. He'll be back. He's the slot receiver. But yeah, in terms of like a starting one and two, they had nothing. I mean, they had nobody knew. It was anyone's guess at that point. Auden Tate and Demir Bird. So, you know, Bird is probably not a number one or number two. So,
let's go to the draft because that's where they made some hay. Obviously, right. Now, number eight overall, they go with Drake London out of USC. I actually, and maybe this was a little optimistic, but I thought that they might actually go after Jameson Williams. Was the injury ultimately was the reason why they went with London over Williams? I love Drake London. As an Arizona State guy, I see a lot of Pac-12 football. I've got season tickets to the Devils and Drake London. It was a couple of years ago that absolutely crushed dreams of the Sun Devils. Do you feel like he moves well enough to be impactful in the NFL?
You know, that's a great question, and that was my main, you know, apprehension with him being drafted there too, because I also like Jameson Williams. I think the injury probably did play a role in that, because I mean, he was clear-cut number one guy, I think, going into the draft, in most of our minds, at least, for that, you know, injury in the championship game. So but Drake London, I understood the pick. He was one of my early projections to the Falcons. He makes a lot of sense. He was a clear, you know, a healthy player at a position of great need. But also, you know, they are, you know, probably a year or two away. So I would have been okay with taking a long-term approach for a guy like, you know, Williams or something. But yeah, London, he's obviously a big target, you know, great catch radius. But can he create separation? I mean, that's what people are saying. I don't really know his particular 40 time. I don't believe he ran at the combine.
He did not, because he was recovering from, I can't remember, it was an ankle or a hamstring that he was recovering
from. Right. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the question. I mean, I think overall, other than the speed, you know, concerns, I don't know if there are even concerns, but other than that, I feel like he looks like a solid, you know, top 10 prospect. You know, it makes sense. He makes sense for the Falcons. I just, I think, you know, there's other directions to go there. And there was a pretty deep receiver class, as we were talking about. So, I mean, I was okay with them going in a different direction potentially, but London, I understand the pick. But yeah, we'll see what he can do. He's probably going to enter the season as number one receiver, so we'll find out right away.
Right. So that's a young core of Drake London at receiver and Kyle Pitts as well. So that Mariota will definitely have some young guys to throw to. I actually really like the first four picks and five of the picks overall. Actually, five or six of them, because Arnold Debicki. He is an athletic freak. They get him at number 38 overall out of Penn State. How, like, do you hope or do you think that he can be an impactful pass rusher even in year one? And how badly does that defense need him?
They really need him. And I do think so because, you know, last year they were dealing with, you know, they changed from a 4-3 to a 3-4 last year, and they brought in Dean Pease. And, you know, nobody really was on the roster that he, you know, drafted or anybody that they kind of had in mind long term for that. So I think, you know, these are the first real guys they get to really put their hands on, like Ebiketti, and then the other kid they took out of Western Kentucky. But yeah, D'Angelo Malone. I think, honestly, Ebiketti has a great chance to start. I don't really see who would keep him out of it. They could potentially go with Aid Ogbundiji, who could potentially start at one of the spots along with Lorenzo Carter. But I think Ebiketti's got a chance to start. And if not, he'll be out there for sure. I mean, they love him so far. They moved up, you know, a few spots to get him, not many, but. I think a lot of people were thinking they might go Malik, you know, Willis there, and they clearly really like the guy a lot and are excited as hell to get him. So, yeah, I think he's got a chance to play a lot this year.
And then Troy Anderson out of Montana State, small school, but an athletic prospect. Desmond Ridder in the third round, that was impressive. Yeah. He's of the quarterbacks in this draft class. I think I like him the best. I know it was a weak quarterback class.
Right,
Willis might have the best upside, But Ritter having played at a high level at a big program with the athleticism that he has.
Pro ready. Right.
Do you think that they view him potentially as the guy that they're going to move to, or is that just a maybe, hopefully?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question because, you know, did they just think, you know, if they really wanted him, would they have taken him a little earlier? Because, you know, to hope he's going to fall in your lap in the third round is probably unlikely. So, I mean, I kind of felt like they just, you know, they're like, all right, we can't pass on Ritter at this point at 74 overall. But I do think they like him a lot, and I think he's got a great chance to be the long-term guy. But it depends on, you know, if he gets on the field this year. If he doesn't, then say if they're in a top five pick position again next year, they have a quarterback sitting there, they're going to, you know, bank on Ritter, or they're going to just, you know, tip hold, punch on the new guy. So I think it creates a good competition. Sorry, my dog's sneaking up on me here a little bit. It's an interesting situation. I like Ritter's long-term chances, and I think they do too, but I just, like I said, like, you know, wait until the third to get the guy you want. Maybe it's Russell Wilson, but, you know, I don't know if you're going to bank on that guy. But if he gets on the field, I think that really helps his chances and show what he can do and, you know, kind of give them some stability in that position. Because I think Mariota can hold it down for a year or two. I'm not sure. He hasn't played in 2 years, you know. He wasn't terrible when he got benched in the first place. I looked a little bit back at his time in Tennessee. It's going to be interesting. I think he's got a shot, but I wouldn't, you know, guarantee they don't take a quarterback in the top five next year if they're that bad or something.
Tyler Allgeier is another intriguing prospect, a guy that I've watched a bit of. I do watch some BYU football. I think he will be a guy who fans will really enjoy because of the way he plays the game. Not right. Super fast, but physical and can do a lot of different things. He was basically BYU's offense the last right. couple, well, especially last year after Zach Wilson left. He was the offense for BYU.
Oh, yeah.
And so
I think he had 23 touchdowns last year, was it? Or 21 or something?
It was ridiculous. he had all the yards and all the touchdowns for the Cougars. Justin Schaefer out of Georgia is not a bad pick late in the sixth round. But if you right. look at the top to bottom of that draft class, obviously mm-hmm. you're expecting an impact from Drake London, Arnold Amekete. Where do you expect to see any sort of impact or role at all this year from the rest of the class?
That's a good question. I think what you were saying earlier with Anderson, that's kind of a, right now it's a little bit of a convoluted position at middle linebacker there. They got Deion Jones, who he could be out of the picture soon. We don't really know for sure. They've seemed to approach the offseason like he's not going to be here. Yeah, signing, they signed Nick Kwiatkowski, and they obviously Rashawn Evans, and they drafted Anderson. So, I mean, I don't think Deion Jones is in their minds is in the picture, but I think Anderson, if Deion Jones is out of the picture, I think he's got a chance to, I don't know if he's going to start, but I think he'll play a big role there because he's versatile. He can play multiple spots up front. Beyond that, D'Angelo Malone, really, really a good natural pass rusher. I think he'll get on the field too a bit, even situationally. I think that's a guy that fans will really like watching. He had like 180 career pressures at Western Kentucky. And last season they were starting, I mean, two guys, Steven Means, who's, you know, a good player. He's not a starting edge rusher. I mean, so obviously I think they have a better group overall, but I think Malone can get on the field. And then Schaefer should provide some depth there. I mean, they at left guard, they have Jalen Mayfield, who did not have a good rookie year. And then also center Matt Hennessy. So both those guys are kind of, you know, not solidified starters. So I think Schaefer should give some competition at guard at least. But overall, I think it's a solid class. That'll probably be the last one that I would say would have an impact.
And then coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, SR Cardinals Talk on the Web, let's now talk about the expectations and hopes for the Falcons 2022 season. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, SR Cardinals Talk on the Web. Still talking to Matt Urban from thefalconswire.com, managing editor over there. We've talked about what the Falcons season was. We looked at their offseason, and now let's look ahead to the coming season. Odds makers are not optimistic at all. They project this team to be bad. What is, for you, kind of the floor and the ceiling for this team, and what would be a reasonable expectation out of the Falcons this season?
Right. So I think if you look at last season, you know, they won 7 games. Overall, they've improved in, I would say, most positions, at least a little bit. And going into the year, I think 7 wins again is probably 7-8 wins is about what I expect. I think their floor is around about 5 or 6. And I think they could maybe win, you know, 10, 11 games if they, you know, get the right breaks, seeing that they won 7 last year and that huge point differential, as we talked about. But, yeah, so my prediction in my official our schedule release thing was I believe it was 8 and 9.
That's not bad. I mean, and if they won 7 games, as long as it's as a 7 and 10 record, that is a much more competitive
exactly
7 and 10 record. But it's kind of interesting because I think Mariota could like it. I guess it's going to come down to kind of what Mariota does, right? Because they have the weapons offensively. It's just a matter of does Mariota does he produce? Or does it sort of stagnate? Because obviously it looks like on defense you're still really young, and defensively it could still be a rocky season. But between the running game and then now adding that, and I think probably the passing game will probably be up and down as well. But
with
Pitts and London, I think you have yourself a reasonable set. Now, the Cardinals will come to town. We'll head to Atlanta. At the end of
week
December,
17?
Yeah, it's week 17, the second to last week. How do Falcons feel about that matchup? If they see that game, is that a game that they expect to win, think as a toss up, or is one that they would have to sneak a win, or either sneak or it would be a clear upset?
I think for me, it looks like a clear loss to me. I mean, I know you guys kind of finished the year tough. But at that point, I believe you would have DeAndre Hopkins back, right?
He's got 6 games. Yes.
Yeah, so that was what I was thinking when I predicted that game. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's the kind of game that they could obviously win. I think Dean Pease does a pretty good job with mobile quarterbacks, so I wouldn't rule out, you know, keeping it close. But, yeah, I think the Cardinals are probably a little bit underrated at this moment because, they finished the season on such a dud. Like, you know, I've watched those final few games. And then being a Michigan guy, I was kind of a Stafford fan, so I followed them, all the Rams a little bit. So I probably watched all the games against the Cardinals. And yeah, I mean, I saw how good they were at certain points. And I think, you know, that how they kind of ended the season, people a little bit writing them off. And I personally am not doing that. So I have them losing that game for sure.
All right. So again, that is Matthew Urban from thefalconswire.usatoday.com, our sister site that covers the Falcons for the NFC South. Matt, aside from the site itself, are there other ways that my listeners can interact with you, follow your stuff?
You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Urban, and I don't have a podcast currently, possibly in the works here, but yeah, right then, just Twitter, I guess. Also, check out my guy Dean Worley, my contributor. He's a pretty good follow on Falcons Follow. Let me read you his Twitter. I think it's just at Dean Worley. Let me just double check for you. But yeah, man, really appreciate you having me on and everything. Looking forward to the season here. Let's see.
It's, you know, we're getting really close. The training camp is now about a month away from, so I think the 26th, well, the Cardinals veterans report on the 26th. So it is, it's just a few weeks away instead of this part of the off season.
For sure. I was going to say, one thing I did want to come back to you a little bit, I just thought of it now, is, fans were a little bit angry about the passing down to Kobe Dean, who kind of fell down there, and Georgia guy.
Yeah.
They were really, when they took Anderson, I meant to say this earlier, nobody really heard of Anderson in terms of the Falcons fan base kind of thing. So that was a big contentious point at the time. But I think people have come around to Troy Anderson since then.
Right. That makes sense because obviously they're in Georgia.
Yeah.
That Georgia defense was incredible. Now, I know Kobe Dean, he fell quite a bit in the draft.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think it came down to medicals, and while he was currently healthy, I think he had to deal with a ton of little things that kind of scared fans away, because if he stays healthy, you have to feel like he's gonna be an impact player, because
he was a top 15 projection. I think most people
absolutely. Absolutely.
And being a Falcons, Georgia Falcons fan, I mean, obviously, they really love the guy. in the second round.
And I experience it here. Now, the difference is that the Georgia program is so much better than the Arizona State program. But anytime that an Arizona State guy is a concept, is a potential pick, Eno Benjamin, running back that we've got on the roster, drafted in 2020, played at Arizona State and was drafted in the 7th round. And fans here, just they want him to be great. Now, there's some great comments from Cliff Kingsbury that this offseason looks like he could be a starting running back. He's not going to be a starting running back. And
oh, right, but that's got
They're like, yeah, finally, finally. But no, I'm like, when it comes to local, like your college, your local college stars, the players there, fans locally are irrational about them. And
I mean,
Eno. I'm a huge Arizona State fan, so I want him to succeed. I'm just like, come on, no. While Cliff said he looks like he could be a starting running back, he's not going to be. They just gave James Conner a 3-year contract.
Right. Yeah, I mean, honestly, Falcons fans think they have something against the University of Georgia, honestly. Ever since I've been here, they're like, I guarantee they won't take a Georgia guy this year, at least they've all years, you know. That having the championship run and such as loaded defense and players all over, they were just like, I guarantee you they don't take a Georgia guy. And they took they did take two back to back in the draft, you know, but kind of guys that bubble guys anyway. So, but yeah, so that's kind of how it is in Georgia here, down there in Georgia with all those guys and Dean for sure. Yeah, I mean, they were just going nuts about not taking N'Kobe Dean, but there's got to be, I feel like what you're saying, like there's got to be some kind of injury issue there because I don't feel like every team passes on him. You know, how far did he fall?
He was picked
third round.
Yeah, it was the third round. I can't remember who, because I was just doing a preview show with the team that got him, and I can't remember where he landed. Let me check.
I think it was Eagles. It was Eagles, right?
Yes, it was the Eagles, and they were really happy to get him because they've been looking for a line.
Sure.
They've been looking for an impact linebacker basically since Jordan Hicks left.
Right.
So yeah. That'll wrap up this segment of our preview show with Matthew Urban. Again, thefalconswire.com. Did you find your contributor's Twitter?
Yes, I did. Let's come back to that. Sorry. So my buddy Dean Worley, his Twitter is @Dean_NFL.
Perfect. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, Matt. And that wraps up this edition of the Rise Up C-Red podcast. Spencer of Cardinals Talk on the Web, episode 363. That was Matt Urban from FalconsWire.com. I'm Jess Root from CardsWire.com. Our next edition will come later this week, which will wrap up in the sixth and final installment of the opponent preview series for the Cardinals' 3 second-place games, as it will face the Eagles, the Vikings, and the New England Patriots in 2022. We will have interviews to preview those 3 opponents. And we'll be back next week with a regular show with Seth Cox as we rank the NFC West and get ready for training camp, which is in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again soon.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up C-Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.